The next meeting of February 22nd, I want to remind you that our speaker will be Admiral James Ellis, who is a retired commander of STRATCOM, and Ellis currently is chairman and president, CEO of Institute of Nuclear Power Operations, so that should be a very, very exciting presentation. Probably the most important part of this meeting for somebody are these car keys that were turned into me. Looks like the ignition key has a green cover on it. It'll be here at the podium, so first come, first serve, okay? Looks like a nice car. Now I would like to introduce, if you would, if we could have a moment of silence, our pastor for the day who will deliver the invocation, and it's Pastor Doug Wigdahl from Emmanuel Lutheran Church. Doug?
I'm sorry. Well, I have a relative named Douglas, but my name is Stephen. I'm pastor at Emmanuel Lutheran Church just down the street on Mooring Line Drive. It's a privilege to be here today to bring an invocation with you and Ambassador Fairbanks. It's my belief that we're all ambassadors in one way or another. Just a few weeks ago, I was out on an airplane and flying from one location to the next. I got pinned against the window seat, and a woman in the middle seat, realizing that she had a pastor pinned against the window seat, decided that she would begin to share with me all the things that were wrong about the church. And so she went on and on about how she doesn't go to church anymore because the church is filled with hypocrites, people who say one thing and do another. And as she continued to rant and rave, finally I stopped her and I said, "Madam, I can understand your frustration, but it's really much worse than you describe it." Being an ambassador is a difficult job in today's world, and so my prayer is that we might offer up for all of us today, as ambassadors for the common good, this invocation. Almighty and gracious God, we pray today that you would grant peace among all the nations. Cleanse from our own hearts the seeds of strife, greed and envy, harsh misunderstandings and ill will, fear and desire for revenge. Make us, O Lord, quick to welcome ventures in cooperation among the peoples of the world, so that there may be woven the fabric of a common good too strong to be torn by the evil hands of war. In the time of opportunity, make us be diligent, and in the time of peril, let not our courage fail. Grant, we pray, that we might all be ambassadors for the common good of others. Especially this day, we ask your blessing upon Ambassador Fairbanks and to all who are gathered here. You have indeed given us this good land as our heritage, Almighty God. Make us always remember your generosity and constantly guide us according to your purpose. Amen.
I want to thank Steve for a nice invocation for Doug. Next part of our program, please commence your salad and your meal. Next part of our program is Wade Keller, who is chairman of our student guest program and is currently treasurer of our organization. So, Wade, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you. Greetings, everyone. We have students from two of the local high schools today, and they're going to be speaking to you for just a minute each. So I'd ask the students from Golden Gate to please join me here on the podium. Students from Golden Gate High School. And our sponsor of the students from Golden Gate is Ray Eshelman. Ray is retired from president and CEO of the L.M. Berrien Company. He enjoys golf and fishing, and he likes to help young people, which is why he chose to be the sponsor. Ray, would you please stand and let us thank you. Now I'm going to introduce the students one at a time, and they will have 1 minute to give you a little bit about themselves, their achievements, and what they hope to do in the future. And let's start off with Valerie Deering. Valerie.
Hi, I'm Valerie Deering. I'm a senior at Golden Gate High School. I'm student body president, my student council, and I play volleyball for my school. I plan on attending the University of Florida and possibly majoring in advertising, and I'd like to, do that as my career, and also I'd like to be a missionary in Africa one day. So.
Great. Thank you, Valerie. And next is Lucas Alvarez. Lucas.
Hi, I'm Lucas. I'm a senior. I want to go to New College of Florida in Sarasota. I want to major in sociology, and right now I'm trying to work with the Coalition of Mockley Workers, and that's it.
Next is Madeline Vieira. Madeline.
Hi, I'm Madeline Vieira, senior at Golden Gate High School. I recently went this summer to Japan, thanks to a scholarship from the Naples Council on World Affairs. I'm class secretary, and I plan to go to the University of Central Florida, and I want to major in international business. Thank
All
you.
Right. And next is Kelly Elizabeth Dyer. Kelly.
Hi, I'm Kelly Dyer. I'm a senior at Golden Gate High School. I'm active in the band and in student government. I plan on going to Florida State University to major in history and international affairs because my father's been in Iraq 3 times, and I think it'd be a great experience to be a United States ambassador and try to help people. And that's about it.
Okay, great. Okay. Okay, I told the students in advance that some of you may want to talk to them after the luncheon when you hear about what their plans are, where they want to go to college. Now, if the students from Naples High would please join me here on the podium. Naples High students. The sponsor for the Naples High students is John Hooley. John is a board-certified trial lawyer. He's partner in the firm of Garba, Hooley, and Holloway. He's been in Naples since 1977, and he is an academic booster of Naples High School. John, would you please stand and let us thank you. And now one at a time. First, let's hear from Andrew Wolfram. Andrew.
Sorry. Good afternoon. I'm Andrew Wolfram. I'm a senior at Naples High School. I have been a member of the National Honor Society for the past 2 years, and I'm also a member of the math club Mu Alpha Theta. I play tennis at the high school, and I want to do crew in college, possibly. I hope to study business, and I'm not going to tell you where I go to college, because if I do, I'm sure somebody in here would definitely hurt me, because there are a lot of rivalries out there, so I'm not going to mention that. But so, thank you.
I know it's a secret, but he did put on his sheet here Harvard. So that's. And next we hear from Carissa Britton. Carissa.
Hi, my name is Carissa Britton. I'm also a senior at Naples High School. I'm interested in international health or global medicine. I hope to possibly attend Georgetown University or Princeton University. And I hope in the future that I can become a doctor, and I would like to work in international health policy and do some humanitarian work both here in the United States and abroad. I'm currently involved at my high school. I'm the vice president of the National Honor Society. I'm currently starting a club with my friend Kristen. It's called the Global Health Initiative. We're trying to raise awareness of global health issues on campus. And I also do a lot of volunteer work with Habitat for Humanity, and I also volunteer at camps for children with HIV and AIDS. So, thank you.
Thank you. Great. And next is Emma Kennelly. Kennelly?
Hi, my name is Emma Keneally. I'm a senior at Naples High. I am an active member of Mu Alpha Theta, the math club, and National Honor Society. I ride horses competitively around the state and also up north. And I'd like to go to Florida State University, and hopefully I'll get admitted into the honors program, and I'll be a math major. Thank you.
And finally, we have Kristen Broxson. Kristen.
Hi, my name is Kristen Broxson. I'm a senior at Naples High School. I've been a part of the symphonic and marching band for 4 years now, and I was named the drum major this year. I was also crowned homecoming queen the night we played Connecticut. That was very exciting. And I'm a part of the Mu Alpha Theta Math Club and treasurer of National Honor Society. And I hope to attend Boston University next year, where I'll major in psychology and then go to graduate school to become a psychiatrist. And thank you for having us.
Okay, another great bunch of students. And now we have an important update and announcement from Ula Norris concerning our scholarship program. Ula.
Thank you. I had promised that I was not going to speak to you today about the Members' Scholarship Fund, but I have some very exciting and important developments to report to you. A member of our board, a person who has already made a sizable donation to the fund, informed the committee the other day of a challenge grant. This member will match any contribution made to the fund up to $1,000 per donation. His offer will be good until May 1, so any paid-up contribution received by that date will mean double the amount into the member's scholarship fund. Any contribution you make after that date is, of course, also very welcome, but that date was chosen so that we would have a good idea of how many scholarships we can award by the end of the semester. The program, by the way, is taking off nicely. Now, this donor wanted to make the offer anonymously, but we felt that it was so exceptional and that you would all want to know who he is, that I was able to prevail upon him to reluctantly agree to my disclosing his identity. He is Bill Gunlix, and I wanted to be able to thank him in front of all of you for his deep caring, commitment, and exceptional generosity. Stick up your hand, Bill, so we can thank you. There's Bill. Thank you very much, Bill. And I hope that many of you will take advantage of this opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you, Yula. Obviously, the club and the board of directors heartily endorse this scholarship program and hope that each one of you can find a way to participate. And again, Bill, thank you for your generosity. Again, we have these keys that were found on the grass, so they'll be here if you need them. I'm sure you will. Someone will. I would now like to introduce person responsible for our speaker today, Dick Bodman, better known as the husband of Karna Bodman. So Dick, if you would, I'd like for you to take over and introduce your speaker. What'd I do? Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, getting way ahead of myself. These keys got to me, I guess. Okay, finish your lunch, and then we'll, as soon as you're finished, start your dessert, we'll introduce Dick. Thank you. Okay, I'll try this again and see if I get it right this time. Again, the keys, don't forget the keys. Now I'd like to introduce Dick Bodman, who's responsible for our speaker today. And so, Dick, I'll turn it over to you and let you commence.
Thank you, Malcolm. And good afternoon, everybody. I have the great pleasure of introducing a very, very long time friend to you this afternoon. I'm going to just say in passing that my friend's great-grandfather was the Vice President of the United States, which I can guarantee you had nothing to do with why Dick is before you today. When Dick was in college, the one thing that wasn't in the write-up was that he was in the ROTC. His college still had an ROTC. And he went into the Navy and almost made the decision to be a career Navy man. And I'm certain he would have been good. But I'm glad he dropped out of there because he's done some wonderful things in the rest of his life. He entered into my life when I was 32 years old, and I was asked to join the government at that time as the Assistant Secretary of the Interior Department, and I was as completely unqualified as one would be at 32 years old. And I was assigned a man in the White House who was 29 years old, who was the director of the President's Domestic Council in charge of energy and the environment. And that was this gentleman you're going to hear today. And for the next 2 years, he provided me unbelievably good counsel, unbelievably good company, wonderful humor, and became a lifelong golf partner, and really just a great friend. The message I want to say about this man is that you hear that somebody was an ambassador or he became negotiator to the peace process, and I want to say it didn't just happen. When Dick was 19 years old and being interviewed by his wife, she said to him, "And what are you going to make out of yourself?" And he said, "I'm going to go to law school and I'm going to go into government and I'm going to be pretty good." She said, "I didn't care what your titles were. What are you going to do?" And he said, "I'd like to be the Middle East peace negotiator." And you know, he did it. And he did it many years later after working in many different assignments, both in and out of government, always doing something useful for mankind, having a good time, and he has this skill of being able to keep the score of everything that's going on at the same time. He remembers every putt I've missed in 37 years. And I do want to say that this is a very interesting man who, in all those 37 years, has only asked back from me one thing, and that's 4 seconds of silence while he swings. I introduce to you Ambassador Richard M. Fairbanks III.
Thank you, Dickie. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to be with you today. I am honored to be in this group because I have seen the other speakers that you've had, and it's been downhill to get to me, but I am happy that most of you have actually stayed. I'm very flattered. I'm also delighted that Dick Bodman and Karna Bodman invited us here, Karna as your director, Dick as friend of director, and as Dick mentioned, he and I met in 1971. He had a little bit of that wrong. I was only 17 when we met. But actually, Karna and I met in 1981, which was long before Karna and Dick met. And so I have known each of them longer than they've known each other, but I was not clever enough to introduce the two of them so they became a couple. They did that without my assistance, and I will never forgive myself for that because they are a perfect couple. I noticed that in our invocation today, the Pastor Wigdahl said that we're all ambassadors. And I think he's right, and I think that's a wonderful sentiment, and I think it even has the virtue of being true. And so what I'm going to do today is to tell you a little secret. And the secret is that each one of you is competent to be the U.S. Middle East negotiator for one reason. This particular set of issues is the number two most covered set of issues by our media, electronic and print, in the United States of America, second only to that political horse race that's going on right now. And you can run, but you can't hide from these Middle East stories. And whether you believe it or not, it's now trapped in your little gray matter, and I'm going to prove it to you. I would like to say I presume the vast majority of people here are Americans. And so I will tell you a story about us Americans and how good we are and why we are the key people helping the Middle East. 1948, when the State of Israel was born in fire and blood, President Truman sent out the first U.S. Middle East negotiator, a fellow named Johnson. And Mr. Johnson spent 2 weeks touring around the region, and he then, at the end of those 2 weeks, ended up in Jerusalem, and they didn't have CNN in those days, of course. So he calls in all the local reporters, and they sit down with him at breakfast. And one of them says to him, "Well, Mr. Johnson, what do you think the chances are of having peace in this region?" And Johnson says, "I've spent the last 2 weeks talking to the Palestinian Arabs and the Israelis, and let me tell you, they're both very smart, interesting, attractive people. But I can't for the life of me figure out why they can't sit down and solve their problems like good Christian gentlemen." This is even a true story. With that kind of cultural sophistication, they always turn to the Americans. We're good. Now, I said that you all were the experts, and let me prove it to you. The substance of this issue, the Middle East peace process issue, of course, began in 1948 when we had all the Arab states try to wipe out Israel and failed. But the keys were 1967 war, 1973 war, in which Israel took over what we now call the West Bank and Gaza. And they are, of course, the stewards still of the West Bank, having turned Gaza back over to the Palestinians. But this provided two very famous UN resolutions. They are called Resolutions 242 and 338, which we came to know as Land for Peace, or Security for Peace, or Peace for Peace, but that was the idea. The Israelis get the land back, give the land back, and the Palestinians promise peace for Israel. Now, what are the issues that they've been negotiating ever since? When Henry Kissinger went out there in 1967, when Jimmy Carter had the Camp David Accords. I was the last Camp David Accord negotiator, not that I ended it, but the Israeli invasion of Lebanon ended it while I was there. And we had that. We then had the Reagan Initiative, 1982. And then we had the Madrid Accords under First President Bush. And then we had Bill Clinton almost winning the Nobel Peace Prize at the end of his regime. And, of course, this is now the big push of President George W. Bush in his last year. So we've had all of these things to go forward. Let me tell you, the substance is exactly the same. The same little pieces of land we're talking about, the same issues between the parties. What are the issues? You have read about the issues. You know them as well as anybody who's out there. They are, what are the borders? Where do we draw the line between Israel and what would be a Palestinian entity? The original ones in 1967 and 73, they said, okay, Israel goes back to its then borders, Palestinians get the rest, time has moved on, Israeli settlements, so what do we do about the borders? Israel has built this fence. Some of what was Palestinian land is no longer on their side. We've got that to deal with, have had that issue to deal with for decades now. Second is the right of return. A number of Palestinian residents of what is now Israel in 1948, when Israel was created, took off. And some of them were scared out by the Israelis. Perhaps a larger number, certainly a larger number, I believe, got out themselves because they didn't think this would last very long, this state of Israel. And their successors in the Palestinian camps have multiplied, and there are a lot of folks out there now who say, we got a right to return to our old land. That, of course, would drown Israel. But at the start of the negotiations, everybody has to deal with it, whether you deal with it at the end by paying for it or what. That's been one of the second of the big issues. The third is Jerusalem. What do you do with the city of Jerusalem? It, of course, is the capital of Israel. Even though most of the foreign embassies, including ours, are in Tel Aviv, all the government entities of Israel are in Jerusalem. and Jerusalem is one unified city under an Israeli mayor. And the Palestinians will say, any negotiation, we get a piece of Israel. A piece of Jerusalem. We always had the eastern part as ours. We need at least that as the capital of whatever would be a Palestinian entity. So the three are borders, right of return, Jerusalem. We know those. They're little ones also. Aren't so little. They're important. But they aren't that order of magnitude. They are water, electricity, what kind of arms a Palestinian entity would have, and whether, if bad things happen, the Israeli armed forces would have the right of hot pursuit. Those are all in the mix. But those three key issues are the exact same three issues that I negotiated, that my predecessors negotiated, Bob Strauss, Saul Linowitz, that my successors, Dennis Ross, and the various secretaries of state and presidents, they haven't changed a bit. They're all still there, and you know them as well as we do. Now, you look at the United States, and we have gone through what I mentioned before, Camp David, the Reagan Plan, the Madrid Accords, the roadmap, which we have now. That's the one we're still supposed to be operating under, the former prime minister of the United Kingdom is now the chief guy for. The roadmap parties are the United States, the EU, the UN, and Russia. Those far parties have underwritten this program that we are trying to put forward now. But the United States is always front and center in this. But the people change. I mentioned the people before me and after me. But if you look at the other countries and entities, you find they're the same. In Israel, for example, the next leadership battle to succeed Mr. Olmert as prime minister will probably be between Ehud Barak and Bibi Netanyahu. Now, back in my day, before most of you were born, or at least some of you, some of the students weren't born anyway. In those days, Ehud Barak was one of my best friends. He's still my best friend in Israel. He was the head of intelligence for the Israeli Defense Forces, one of their most famous generals. And Bibi Netanyahu was at that stage the number two man in their UN directorate, and then came back into the Likud government. These were key leaders then. They're still the same leaders now as the next generation turns over into something that is four generations farther along for us. In Jordan, I used to deal with King Hussein, one of the most wonderful people I ever dealt with, fabulous guy. The big change there is he died, but who replaced him? His son, King Abdullah. So we've had a continuation of the Hashemite kingdom there. By the way, Dick Bodman said I had to tell anecdotes. I will get to anecdotes. Just a little substance before we get there. Then in Saudi Arabia, we have King Abdullah. The king I used to deal with in Saudi Arabia was King Fahad, who is his brother. Not a big change there. Same foreign secretary they've had then and now is when I was there and now. In Egypt, we have, of course, Mubarak. I first met Mubarak before I became Middle East negotiator when he was vice president. Then Sadat was assassinated. Mubarak became the president, and he still is the president. And now we're talking about his son succeeding him. So there's a certain continuity there. In Syria, the one I dealt with was Hafez al-Assad, who has been the longtime president of Syria. His son is now the president of Syria. Certain continuity. Are you getting the theme? And then finally, the Palestinian Authority, where Arafat in absentia, we couldn't deal with him because he was a terrorist in my day, but the Palestinian Authority, Palestinian Liberation Organizations, what we called it then, they were in the government, was of course headed by Arafat, and Arafat's right-hand man was Abu Mazen, Mr. Abbas, who is now the head of the Palestinian Authority. So this thing continues along with the same players, with the same interests, and the question is, how do we move out of this box, and what is the box? Well, the Israelis have really evolved over this period of four decades I'm talking about, because when I was dealing with the Israelis, they didn't even call the West Bank the West Bank. They called it Judea and Samaria. These are lands that God gave to us. We recaptured them from those evil Arabs in the 67 and 73 war, and by God, they're not getting it back. And that was the position. We don't talk about the West Bank. It's very offensive to the Israelis. We call Judea and Samaria. Americans called it the West Bank, but didn't make them happy. So, over time, that view has evolved. And so you now have the position of the current government is there should be a two-state solution, which is what we've been talking about all the way along, some kind of a Palestinian entity, which we now call a state, thank goodness, and the Israeli state. But if you look at what's happened to Israel over that period of time, all of the top, tough, famous difficult war leaders of Israel, the top generals, came around to the point of view no matter how hard they started against it. The first was Moshe Dayan. Then you have Yitzhak Rabin. Then you have Ehud Barak, whom I just mentioned, who, of course, went on to be head of the IDF, Israeli Defense Force, and then prime minister, and even Eric Sharon. Now, Eric Sharon was the defense minister when I was there. He, of course, has had a stroke after he was prime minister. He's still alive but not sentient. But Eric Sharon was the toughest of the tough. He was really tough, and he came around to the two-state solution. Why? Did they all of a sudden get soft and wimpy? No. They looked at the demographics, and the demographics are that the Arab birth rates are so much higher than the Israeli birth rates that Israel is faced with a choice. They can either be a Jewish state or a democratic state, but they can't be a Jewish democratic state with the birth rates the way they are, not keeping the West Bank and Gaza. And so everybody realized that. They also realized that modern warfare is different from what it was in 1967 and 73, and the actual land holding is not nearly as important as who's holding the land on the other side and what your relationship with them is, because it's not like a ravening group of tanks is going to come screeching out of no place to invade Israel. The problem now is either individual terrorism, which Lord knows we just had our first suicide bombing in Israel in over a year. We got used to it before the fence. Or the missiles. And we're talking about the missiles with Iran, we hear about it. Syria, we worry about. Other missiles, and they can hit you very quickly. And, of course, it doesn't matter whether you have 15 miles of safety or 25 miles of safety or whatever. And so it is the hearts and the minds and the ability to trust the people you're dealing with on the other side. Now, on the Palestinian side, the rejection of the situation has always been there is no state of Israel. If you went into Yasser Arafat's office, you saw a picture that showed here is Jordan, here is the Mediterranean Sea, and nothing is in the middle because that's all our land. The Israelis stole it. Keep breathing. We'll get it back. And for a while there, it looked like Mr. Arafat had decided that reality was going to shove him into a two-state solution. But in the famous negotiations with President Clinton, he decided, no, he's going to go back to his maximalist position. Nobody is ever going to offer more than Ehud Barak did on behalf of the Israelis then, 95% of the land that the Palestinians had pre-1967. And, of course, at the end of the day, Arafat walked away from that because I think he decided he would rather be the head of a government in exile, which didn't really exist and treated as a world statesman, than be the head of a little rump country. And so the rejectionists won out once again. Now, the irony of the rejectionists winning out once again is that if you have a public opinion poll, and they have been run constantly since the 1967 era, 75% consistently on both sides, both the Israeli side and the Palestinian side, said, enough of this. We want to live in some peace, some security. We want a better life for our children. We want them to be educated. Let's finish it and get it done. And still the political leadership can't do it. Now, the United States has been pushing one position constantly. We want the thing behind us. It hurts us. It hurts our image in the world. We want peace. But we have found out that we are necessary. Everybody always wants us involved, as we continue to be for every Republican and Democratic administration. But we are not a sufficient answer to bringing this. Now, we've given a veto to the extremists on both sides, and we still have that veto in place. For example, on the Israeli side, I mentioned Yitzhak Rabin, one of the very tough military leaders who became prime minister, moved over, had the famous handshake with Mr. Arafat in the White House lawn. And what happened to him? He was assassinated by the Palestinians? Nope. He was assassinated by the radical elements within his own society by a ultra-right-wing Israeli who thought he was selling out the national interest of Israel. And similarly, the radicals within the Palestinian side, Hamas, of course, is in charge now of Gaza, and you see they say, anybody who makes a deal with Israel for one piece of our land, even if we get a two-state solution, is selling out our long-term interest. Don't give in until we get everything. And those are the rejectionist sides, 20 to 25% on both sides, gridlock. There we are. Now, what's it like to be out there doing this negotiation? Dick Bodman said to tell you a few true life stories. One true life story that was a great shock to me, as you heard, I was only 40 when I became Middle East negotiator. I had not spent the flower of my youth in the Middle East. I'd been there once in the U.S. Navy. I didn't speak Arabic. And Al Haig, who was then Secretary of State, calls me into his office and says, I'm going to make you Middle East negotiator. Are you surprised? And I said, no, because you heard the story that my wife and I had this conversation. He looked somewhat baffled. But he said, everybody is going to say that you're too young and inexperienced for this job. But he said, but look at your predecessors. As negotiator, we had Saul Linowitz, we had Bob Strauss. What was their background and expertise? They were Washington lawyers. You're a Washington lawyer, go do it. And so I said, okay. That was it, this is true. And so I said, fine. And so I said, well, what these guys are going to do is everybody will tell me my instructions every day, where I should go, what I should say, and I will just be the stalking horse and the front man. So I inherited a staff of 12 people from my predecessors as Camp David negotiators. And I said, okay, guys, where do we go? He says, your choice. I said, okay. So then we started our little caravan, and we would go around wherever I felt like going that day. We had our own plane, and everything was very nice, our own security guys. And we would go to Israel, we would go to Syria, we would go to Egypt, we'd go to Saudi Arabia, and, you know, wherever the spirit moved. And the State Department never told me where to go. I would report back at the end of the day saying where we had gone and what we'd done. And I said, aren't you giving me instructions as to what to say? They said, you're the negotiator. And I said, well, okay. And you get what you pay for. So we had common sense. We used common sense. Those were the days when we used common sense. It was long ago. You may not remember. But it was very exciting, obviously. You're out there. Another thing that I presumed, which you might presume, I told you you could all be negotiators, you know the substance. One thing that you might presume is what you do is you go out there and they give you talking points. They give you pieces of paper which set the meets and the bounds of what it is that the Americans are in favor of and therefore what we are going to say in these meetings. Here are your talking points. And you go into the meeting with the king and the president and the foreign minister and you say, here's what I'm here to tell you. Wrong. I never got a single page of talking points in my entire life. They said, do the right thing again. And the talking points were done by whoever was doing it. There's a certain logic to that because you're not really selling the talking points. The dirty little secret is the reason you don't sit there and read talking points is you're not selling the talking points, you're selling yourself. The amount of importance in the personality of the person that you're representing your country, but you're representing your country individually. And you're dealing with these other people, all those guys I mentioned who are all the same, either them or their sons, that we were dealing with, they are individuals, and you're dealing with each other as individuals. You're pursuing your national interest as you understand it, as you've grown up with it, as your country believes that you are worthy of speaking about, but you're dealing with each other as individuals. So every one of these meetings that you go into, on the Israeli side and the Arab side, in the deepest, darkest, most dangerous moments, we'd always start with humor. Always start with humor. One thing that tremendously surprised me, except with Menachem Begin, who was not the funniest guy in the world. But everybody else, humor. And so, for example, you would walk into a meeting with one of the Arab leaders, and they would expect you to tell a good story about Israel. So one of my favorite stories, you have a stock of these things you could build up. So one of my stock stories was about Henry Kissinger, who was a very funny guy, in addition to being a very smart fellow. He tells stories, which are often stories. He claims this one's a true story. 1967, he's about to go off in the disengagement talks with the Syrians, and Henry is called into Golda Meir's office. Golda was then the Prime Minister of Israel, and she says, Henry, we're particularly delighted that at this difficult, dangerous, crucial moment in the history of the State of Israel, we have a Jew doing the negotiating for us. Henry says, Golda, you must remember, I'm an American first, I'm Secretary of State second, I'm a Jew third. She says, that's all right, Henry. In Israel, we read from right to left. See? Proving once again that you guys would make good Arabs. They all laughed at that joke, too. Then on the Israeli side, you had to tell Arab stories, of course. And one of my favorite Arab stories, I actually heard in Egypt, but it was a story about an American, a Russian, then a Soviet, but it was now called Russians, American and Russian and a Saudi Arabian were having a conversation. And they were talking about whether sex was fun or whether it was work. Close your eyes and ears, students. Talking about whether sex was fun or was work. And so the Russian said, well, it must be work because it's a duty to the state to propagate the race. The American said, no, it must be fun because it's one of the few things that's not regulated by the federal government. So they turned to the Saudi to referee the dispute. And the Saudi thinks about it and he says, well, it must be fun because if it were work, we'd have a Pakistani do it. So when you look at CNN and you see these very serious people walking out of these negotiations, that's what they were doing in those negotiations. They weren't reading talking points. They were projecting themselves with humor, hopefully some understanding, trying to talk about national interest. One thing you couldn't do, you could tell jokes, but you couldn't deviate from what you were saying from one side to the other. Because if you tried to say one set of positions the United States supported to the Arab side and one set to the Israeli side, they'd know that you were cutting it and you would have no credibility. So you had to have the strength of character not to bend their direction when you're talking to them, but to say, here's what the United States of America recommends and stands for, and here's where we are. And it had to be the same on both sides. So those are the secrets of negotiation. Now, where do we go from here? I now have four minutes left. Oh, I'm so happy. I'm talking fast because I gave a whole course on this at the University of Miami, a whole semester. Tough to do this in 25 minutes. The problem now is you have very weak political leadership on both sides, the Israeli side, Palestinian side. Both sides have decided two-state solution. The Israeli government, United States government out loud, we used to do it in private, and the Palestinian leadership, that is Abu Mazen, Mr. Abbas, they've all said two-state solution. So we're almost there. But the Israeli prime minister is weak. His standing, of course, makes President Bush look like he's an overwhelming hero at home. And the Palestinian side, you can see what happened to Mr. Abbas. He is still in charge of things in the West Bank, but of course he lost the election to Hamas in Gaza. And so they're both very weak, even though their heart and in my mind, their common sense is in the right place. Now, how do we get out of this? We've got Prime Minister Blair, as I said, running around for the quartet. We have the President personally and Condi Rice beating the drum on behalf of the United States of America. We don't seem to be getting there, even though everybody's trying very hard. Are there any things we can think of outside the box? Maybe a couple. One might be a referendum, because the political leadership's weak. I've told you 75% on both sides want a peace deal. How about a referendum in which the 75% could say, yes, we want a deal, and therefore give some political credence to weak leaders to be able to do it? Another is people have said, why don't we have an international force put in this border between Israel and the Palestinians? A little tough because nobody wants to be on that force, including the Americans, where you get shot at by both sides, as we've seen with the UN and peacekeepers. So what we're faced with is a very difficult conundrum where the leadership, American interest, I believe the national interest of Israel and the national interest of Palestinians all come together in the same place, but we can't get over the hump to get it done. Leading to my final point is a question for the audience. What is the difference in the Middle East between an optimist and a pessimist? The answer, of course, is the optimist is always wrong. And on that happy note, we will turn to your questions.
He's a great joke teller. I've heard about half of those stories when I was sitting next to him at lunch. Thank you very much, Mr. Ambassador. I would like to present to you, on behalf of the Forum Club, a memento of your visit here, Marco Island and the city of Naples.
God, this one looks like my first wife.
And we hope you and Shannon enjoy those.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Now, questions and answers. Dick?
Thank you. First wife?
Richard, nobody was interested in what you had to say.
That's life.
Wow. One of the students has asked
really simple question for you. How do you counter the thesis that Israel is a proxy for the U.S. and its hegemony in the Middle East?
Hegemony? Which one of the students came up with that word? I thought you were dingbat Florida students. What is this hegemony? That is a very, very good question. One that is asked a lot, but not with as great articulation as that one. But that is a very key point, because when you travel around not only that region, but around the world, people say, you silly Americans, you are just so in love with the Israelis that you prop them up, and you are that is your anchor out in the Middle East. One of the Israeli prime ministers used to call Israel America's unsinkable aircraft carrier in the Middle East. Well, it used to be that the strategic interest of having the ability to have boots on the ground, American friends, American troops when we wanted it in Israel was pretty important, not so important anymore. And so therefore, the U.S. national interest is not in hegemony. We don't have an empire. We don't want an empire. Certainly any president who ran on the basis of we are going to have an American empire would get fewer votes than Tom Tancredo, probably. Maybe he said that. I don't know. Who knows what he said? So that's not the reality, but it certainly is often the perception. It's a perception that we have to take on by trying to do the right thing, by explaining that we're doing the right thing, and by an even-handed approach that we can stand up for on both sides of the equation and around the world. And that's what I said the key on negotiation in my mind is: don't shade the issue on either side. Don't try to say what this side wants you to hear, that side wants you to hear. Explain what you're for and why, and stick with it.
Well done. Well, here's an even easier question. Other than oil, why do we care?
About?
That's the question.
Okay. Other than oil, why do we care? I was talking to someone before lunch, and we said, what has become a cliche, that if the export from the Middle East region was bananas, you wouldn't hear as much about it. CF Central Africa. It's true. I think that's true. On the other hand, it is also the strategic crossroads of the world, has been before oil, was, of course, the place where Muhammad started the fastest-growing religion in world history, in the wilds of the Saudi desert, which spread within 100 or 200 years to various parts throughout not only the Middle East, but what turned into Europe and also into Asia. Obviously, that's why you have the largest Muslim country in the world today being Indonesia. And so a lot has gone on there. We talk about the cradle of civilization, and the Fertile Crescent is the cradle of civilization. This is, you could argue, the heartland of human intellect. And so these have been important people throughout the history of humans. I think they would continue to be important people because of who they are, and the fact that oil is there has given strategic importance to the Saudis, who were, of course, Bedouins wandering around without a whole lot of acidification. But the Egyptian culture has been there for thousands of years, and the Egyptians, of course, consider themselves the center of Arab culture. And I would think that everybody has needed to deal with this culture long before there was oil. If you read about Napoleon Bonaparte, he decided when his superiors then in the government told him to go invade England, he didn't invade England, he went down and invaded Egypt. And he was going to use Egypt as his jumping off point to go down to India and snatch that out of the British Empire. So again, strategic interests, the strategic location, the strategic group of humans, and the history of the region argue for the fact that we wouldn't be dismissing that region even if they didn't have oil.
I've tried to categorize some of these questions, Dick, into general issues here. We've had three or four, the gist of which is, will Israel tolerate a nuclear Iran or other nuclear threat in the region?
That's an unknowable question. The rest of the region has tolerated the reality of the knowledge that Israel itself has the nuclear capability. This has been semi-open secret for decades. You noticed in the newspaper, they said very openly, when you had this recent, the most recent suicide bombing in Israel, it was down in Dimona, which is, it said in the newspaper, the place where the Israeli nuclear facilities are alleged to be. And so, obviously, on the Israeli side, the neighbors have known that Israel had a nuclear capability. Will Israel be able to live with the reality of anybody else having it? That is, as I say, an open question. And that was one of the problems that we've had with the whole weapons of mass destruction that we now has turned into a cliche, looking for them and not finding them in Iraq. But remember, in Iraq, we know they had weapons of mass destruction because it wasn't theoretical, because they used them. Saddam used them against the Iranians, and he used them against his own people. The weapons of mass destruction were gas, but he also had programs in nuclear and in biological. Now, what happened when the Iraqis started building a nuclear facility? The Israelis took it out in 1981 in an air raid. Bango. That was the end of that. There's a rumor that what the Israelis hit in Syria, 6 or 8 months ago, was a nuclear facility in Syria, but we're not sure about that. It was something in Syria that they hit, which is no longer on the map. And so the Israelis are unlikely, in my view, to just lie there and say, oh, you want to have nuclear? Well, good for you. And that's what the key on this whole Iranian thing is, because some people argue in our country, okay, the Israelis are going to take out any Iranian nuclear facility before it becomes operational. Let them do it. Well, it ain't that simple. Obviously, it would be a political nightmare because we would have to know about it. The Israelis would have to use our refueling capability. They don't have the ability to fly over there and come back. It's not close by, as close by to them as Iraq was, where they could do it. And they would have to be done with our assistance. And so we would be complicit in the eyes of the world. So it is our necks on the line as well as theirs. That's why our administration, for both Republicans and Democrats, has been fighting so hard to use economic sanctions and diplomacy to make sure that Iran does not get a nuclear capability, because it is not something with which we look on happily, not just because of the Israeli dimension, but because they also have long-range missiles, and they could hit both our friends in Europe and potentially even someday us. And that's why the U.S. and Russia have been fighting over these missile batteries in Eastern Europe, where we say those are to protect against the Iranians, and the Russians say, no, it's to protect against us, and we go back and forth on that issue. So the whole Iranian context is very, very troublesome and difficult, and that's why we're unhappy with the Russians and the Chinese for not being more together with us and the Western Europeans in taking on this very difficult problem, because the more international the reaction against the Iranians is, the better chance we have of solving it short of hostilities.
I have just three more questions here.
I only have two more answers.
That's all right. I had a number of questions that were asked on this very same subject, which is, since the situation over there has been the same as long as most of us have been alive, and as Dick said, with many of the same parties, do you think it's going to make any difference if one group of candidates makes it to being our president versus another in this country? Is there anybody with a particular advantage among these contestants?
I don't think so. I am of a particular political persuasion, which I will keep secret. The fact that I worked in the Nixon administration, the Reagan administration, might be a clue, but I will keep it secret. But there's one thing that is very interesting if you look back at our political history since 1948, certainly since 1967-73, and that is Republican administrations, Democratic administrations come and go. One set of policies has maintained itself all the way through, and that is a remarkable consistency on behalf of American policy dealing with the Middle East in general and the peace process in particular. And all of these debates that we have seen, what have we had, 18 Democratic debates, I don't know, 10 or 12 Republican debates, do you remember any tiny thread of difference except for Ron Paul? Take out Ron Paul. anybody else other than Ron Paul has taken any different position on this set of issues, either on the Republican Party or the Democratic Party? No. No. There is uniformity among the advisors. I know all these advisors. Obviously, we've been around Washington a long time. The advisors and the candidates, both on the Republican side and the Democratic side, there isn't a teacup's worth of difference, in my view, substantively between any of them. There will be differences in style, differences in personnel, differences in the way in which people attempt to deal with the issue, whether a particular Republican or a particular Democrat is elected. But I don't think substantively you can say right now that there will be a difference among them.
Dick, I'm going to ask one of my own here, but there are some questions that more or less allude to this. If, by some miracle, America were to find a way to become significantly less dependent upon oil from the Middle East, would these issues drop to a little lower level of tension, or would they still stay?
Well, you phrased that question, Dick, in terms of the United States. And, you know, let's suppose that we in the United States came up with the magic wand on alternative energy, and we kept that for ourselves. And so what we did was every president since Richard Nixon, who invented something called Project Independence, has talked about weaning ourselves off foreign oil with a notable lack of success. Talk goes like this. Oil dependence also goes like this, so nobody's been able to do it. But if you're talking about a change in the world oil demand because we have gotten hydrogen or we've gotten, you know, something I don't know right now, and so world oil demand is lower, certainly there would be an impact on the countries of the region and on OPEC countries generally, on our friend Chavez in this hemisphere, on the Canadian oil sands, on Russia, on Norway. Everybody who's got oil would certainly be impacted if the demand for oil has crested and is going down because of things coming in. Now, there's the other side of the coin, which is a very famous geologist and financier named Matt Simmons, who wrote a book called Twilight in the Desert, is of the view, A, that Saudi Arabia's production has peaked and they can no longer be the world's swing supplier because they haven't got any new oil wells or new oil fields, and that the rest of the world is also on the downslide, and therefore oil is going to become more and more and more dear and expensive in the few years and decades ahead. And so that would argue for we better speed up this idea of alternate energy, and that's why you see people like Tom Friedman, who has been writing articles and is now writing a book on how we've got to have the famous Manhattan Project for alternate energy. And so that whole set of things has enormous economic implications, enormous geostrategic implications, and you tell me how that technology is going to come out. You're the technologist, not I, because I think that is perhaps the most important question. What happens if we could look 20 years in the future back to now? That may be the single most important development in the next 20 years, whether we do something effective to help wean ourselves, not just in the United States, but the world from oil. Whether we're successful that or not may well tell about whether we have peace or war, whether we have a sustainable economy, and a few small questions like that.
So there you have it. And thank you. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you all.
Great speech. Let me remind you to leave your badges in the baskets as you leave, and thank you again for being here today.